Welcome to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.7. I'm Judy Getty, and I will be hosting the show today as we discuss Tainted Witness, Why We Doubt What Women Say About Their Lives by Lee Gilmore. My guest is Rachel Gernat. Welcome, and thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you, Judy.
So let's start with just a general impression of the book. I think when we were talking a little bit before, we love the title, we love the subtitle, but we're a little disappointed.
Absolutely. Loved the title. Loved the subtitle. I had visions in my mind of what this was going to be about, and it was not.
And we'll go into details about the content, but I pick books based on reviews that I've read, so I should have gone back and looked for the review because I'm sure it was glowing, and I think this is a super important topic, but she just lost me.
Oh, definitely. I liked how it started out. I thought this was going to be great. And then just the tangents that it went off was too radical for me and maybe too small of an audience that would get behind that. And it lost to me the idea of what we were talking about.
Right. And I think just to kind of put some perspective on that, too, when I looked at the book and when I asked you to be my guest, because you've been a district attorney, you've prosecuted cases where women are telling their stories. And so my thinking was we're going to be more focused on criminal kinds of cases. And find that it was, also civil cases and also testimonials that she wanted to talk about. But then I think because her background is not as an attorney, her background is as a gender and women's studies instructor who seems to look at memoir and testimonies. So I think she brings a different focus to this topic.
Right. I agree with you. I mean, when I saw the title, I thought the same thing, criminal law, especially with everything that's been going on in the press and the news. And then there were some cases, again, just like you did. I thought, okay, just a different perspective of looking at a witness, a testimonial. That's an interesting way to look at it. The idea of that would be a fun way to look at it. But then I actually did have to go back and look to see what her background was because I thought, where is this book going? I don't feel like we're talking about the topic of why we're doubting women. We're actually picking apart what they're saying and almost going after some of the women, which I did not feel like the book was supposed to be about. I thought it was going to be more on this idea of why do we doubt what people say, looking at it specifically women as witnesses, mm-hmm. or women with testimonials. But I found a lot of points that I was making notes that I thought, well, she's now judging other women for saying what they're saying and doing what they're doing, which lost me.
Okay. And see, I didn't take it that way. I thought she was saying it in terms of how other people would do that. And so she talks about how these criticism will stick to the witness, and that's what taints them.
Right.
And we'll get into some of the specifics of what taints them. But one of the things, I guess I appreciated that she brought up the public forum, that were also tried in, the public forum. And that goes for no matter what kind of case it is, whether
Absolutely.
It's criminal or civil. Or
I think it goes for when a lot of women are stepping forward to either tell their story or to speak on behalf of someone else, like you said, whether it's in a courtroom or whether it's at a hearing or anything. The initial thought is to question it as opposed to believe it.
And we're going to get into some of the, current examples, too. But that's it exactly, that women's stories are not taken apparently at face value.
Right.
That they're going to be challenged. And like Gilmore says, something is going to be put out there about them as individuals that doesn't have anything necessarily to do with what has happened to them.
Exactly.
But taints their testimony.
Exactly.
Okay. So why do you think, if we're just talking globally, why do you think women's stories are less credible?
Well, globally, I think it first depends on how women are viewed in whatever society you're in. So if it's a global aspect in your country, how are women viewed? Are they less of citizens? Which right away is going to have you say, well, you don't have a voice or you don't have an opinion or we don't trust you as much as we trust somebody else. In our society, I think it's a lot of times when women are coming forward, they're coming forward to say that something happened to me by another person, often a man. And I think that deep down, there's still that question that of, well, why would you question what he said? Or this person's a upstanding member of our community. They would never do something like that. And what I have learned throughout my jobs is that you don't know what happened unless you were there. And then, obviously, in a court case, you have to use other evidence to show what happened. But I think people automatically are going to distrust anything someone says about someone that they view as an okay person.
Right. That they're a good guy. And I think that's the binary way of that our culture still looks at women. We have good women and we have bad women.
Yes.
And so if a woman comes forward with some testimony about something that's happened to her, something that's been done to her, some experience that she's had, and if that's a negative thing, then she must be a bad woman, and that's why that bad thing happened to her.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, and I learned this during a lot of jury trials, is that women almost judge other women harder. So the initial thought was that, well, we're women, I would get what you're saying. But in some ways, it's not. And what I've come to realize, it's the ability to separate. Well, that would never happen to me because I don't go to parties. That would never happen to me because I don't do drugs. And it's a way to say, well, that's you, that's not me. Almost like a self-preservation.
And it's sad, but that is true. I think that, you know, when I teach classes about advocating for victims and do this kind of work too, that is how we cushion ourselves, how we feel better or how we feel safe. That because I wouldn't engage in those behaviors or do what that woman does or did, I'm safe.
Right. And then I'm good, you're bad.
Yes. And then it becomes that. And it unfortunately gets reinforced on many different levels. So Gilmore spends a lot of time with the Anita Hill testimony. And so like we said, we like the beginning.
Yes.
And the Anita Hill case is certainly one where we see a woman who's, you know, she didn't even really
want to. Forward, right.
She did not want to.
Right.
And did you go back and look at any of the tapes? I mean, you're much younger than me, so you probably don't remember.
Well, I do remember her.
Okay.
Yeah, when it happened. And I didn't go back and look at tapes, but I have over the course of my life and career referred back to the Anita Hills because it was one of those first, you know, large public scale forums that brought this issue forward and then quickly got swept away. So I have at times gone back to study that. So I was very familiar with that. But what I had forgotten was that she did not want to be involved. And that also gets forgotten.
Yes.
That
yes.
She was thrust forward and then had to talk about everything and then was and then immediately distrusted because of you know, did what she was asked to do and then immediately distrusted because of it.
Yeah. I like the part where even she was saying that, and I can still picture it. I had meant to go back and watch some of the old film too, but I can picture her when she testified, she almost looked frozen.
Yes.
And so she talks about how she didn't move.
Right.
She knew that everything she did was going to be judged.
Yes, absolutely. And I found that to be so telling that she couldn't blow her nose. She couldn't take a sip of water.
Right.
She couldn't do anything that would make her think she was nervous, yet by doing nothing, she looked unaffected. So it was, and that's how I remember that,
mm-hmm.
And but that's how she even poised it in the book, was that it didn't matter what she did.
And I know you talk, when you talk to witnesses, when I talk to women too, in going to court, you know, women, they're expected to have this emotional response, but they can't be too emotional,
right?
Because then they look crazy or out of control.
Right. Right. And that's absolutely true. And somehow you're supposed to be able to manage this perception while you're reliving a traumatic event or explaining something that you saw or that you did. But yet, exactly. You have to also have this perfect poise, which I'm not exactly sure what that is, because then you look fake. So it's almost a, and I think Gilmore does a great job of saying, pointing that out and saying it didn't matter what she was saying. People were judging her on how she was appearing.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a piece that we can, you know, take across to many other examples. But the interesting thing that I did not know, because I have not read Clarence Thomas's book or Anita Hill's book.
I did not read his book.
You know, Gilmore does say we have to have context, and you and I both agree with that, too.
Absolutely.
Any story we tell,
absolutely,
there has to be some of that background,
yes,
to give you the context.
Yes.
And so in the context in this case was that Clarence Thomas had devised this false narrative about his life.
Yes, I did not know that. And I found that fascinating that she was picked apart. Everything she said, and so therefore it meant what she was reporting about her interactions with Thomas couldn't be true. But no one either wanted to pick apart him or raise that as an issue of his credibility.
Right. Because then we have this whole other context that's rubbing up against that, which is that the Senate really wanted to,
yes,
approve a African-American,
yes,
to the court.
Yes.
And they had bought into this false narrative.
Yes.
We should say the false narrative was that he was raised by grandparents. He was a self-made man,
yes,
that he didn't rely on affirmative action, that he, you know, he had,
right,
these conservative ideals. And so that's what he was going to bring to the court. And the,
correct,
Senate wanted that,
yes,
picture,
yes,
that story.
Yes. And it turned out that wasn't true.
No.
At all. I mean, some of them, you know, his family makeup and some of that,
mm-hmm,
was true, but the level to which he took it to create this picture of him was not.
Well, it's such a denial. I mean, this is a little rabbit trail, but, you know, it's such a denial on his part to say he's self-made. Nobody,
right,
is self-made.
Right.
And, of course, he benefited from affirmative action. And so now for him to take the position that he's anti-affirmative,
right,
action. Yeah. I got mine. Now everybody else, too bad,
yeah,
for you.
Yeah, I know, and I thought that as well. I thought, well, you benefited from it. You got to where you were for a couple of these different policy reasons that you're against.
Mm-hmm.
And now you want to stand against them without even saying, I benefited from it. However, this is how I feel. It just was to just create this perfect picture. And I think I thought you were correct to bring it up, and so was Gilmore, was to talk about the fact that there was this third party that they wanted him as a candidate. So it almost was like it didn't matter,
right,
what she said or who came forward, which she also points out is they didn't allow other people to come forward, which is maybe more of a commentary on the process than looking at women. But you had other – one of the things with Anita Hill is why you don't believe her is, well, there's no proof. How do we know what you're saying is true? Well, then they had this – the other female, whose name escapes me, who said, oh, no, this happened to me, too. And they said, well, we don't want to hear from you.
And, you know, and some of the things she was bringing up, of course, were behaviors that had occurred with just the two of them in the room.
Right.
But when she talked about some of those things, like you're saying, that other witness that could have testified to his apparently his pornography,
yes,
habit.
Yes.
And he would share those, you know, what he liked to watch.
Right.
And he not only shared those with Anita Hill, but with other women.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And so they could verify that and make her story more credible.
Right. And they wouldn't.
Right.
And so to me, that was a systematic comment on the witness. Like we're making you come forward mostly, it almost seemed like, so we can knock you down to build him up.
Or make the appearance that we listen to you.
Right.
However.
Right.
Yes.
We don't want to listen that much.
We don't want to hear that much. And, you know, when all is said and done, he's more believable than you.
Right. Even though he didn't have to say anything, really.
No.
I mean, if I recall, unlike the recent hearings we've had, he didn't say anything. He basically sat almost quiet other than when asked specific questions. He didn't stand up and give his own testimonial or sit up, I guess, at the Senate, like she had to.
But in the book, I mean, his, like, moral outrage of being,
yes,
you know, put through that.
Right, right. And she's just, you know, she forever, I mean, who, I guess there are people that don't know Anita Hill, but now they do again because her name was brought back up again with the most recent Supreme Court justice. So here's this woman who, you know, has experienced something that she didn't want to come for. They didn't have the workplace protections like they do now, and she's forever a household name with really probably forever tainted by and a brilliant woman. I think I hadn't realized her background,
mm-hmm,
of how educated she was and how intelligent she was. And I think if somebody like that is questioned, you can see why women who don't have any of those attributes would not want to come forward.
So let's make the comparison first, though, before I do that, I will let our listeners know, if you've just joined us and you hear how irritated we are, it's because Rachel Gernat and I are talking about Tainted Witness, Why We Doubt What Women Say About Their Lives by Lee Gilmore. So we were talking about Anita Hill hearings. And I mean, it couldn't, this book was obviously published before the recent Kavanaugh
Correct.
And Christine Blasey Ford situation,
right.
but couldn't be more of a parallel.
Absolutely. I mean, it's sad as well.
Yes,
when you think of the decades that have passed.
Yes.
Right. And almost, worse to Dr. Ford than they were to Anita Hill. Though, even though they didn't believe her, I don't recall there being as much attack on just her as a person. You know, like in the hearings themselves, people were saying things. But the senators, I mean, they weren't, I don't recall them being as outright rude and just like.
Well, because they didn't question her.
Exasperation, right.
So I think what the Senate learned from the Anita Hill hearing to the, Dr. Ford hearing was we have to look more sympathetic. And so in order to do that, we will get a female attorney
yes,
to question her. And then that way that group of white men won't be,
right.
The ones who are looking like the bad guys,
right.
Yeah, picking apart this woman's story.
Right. Which, in my opinion, didn't do anything to soften the blow or change the system at all. It just made it like a trial, quite frankly.
Well, and that's, some of the feedback, right?
Right.
Is that she was more on the hot seat.
Yes.
And, but it seemed to me that the outpouring from the, court of public opinion was initially how credible she was.
Yeah, it was interesting. There were some people that right away said, it's been too long, she can't be credible. And that's a common argument. And if you don't work in the field, you could see why that initially would be questioned. But again, she was not somebody who jumped up and down and said, I want to come forward. And people didn't realize
she
that.
She was reluctant.
She had sent the information way back when his name percolated up during the initial election to just say, should this become an issue, here's what you should know. And then she's called out on it again. So a woman who thought she would do the right thing, pass the information on, and then continue on with her life was suddenly thrust into the spotlight. And I think that whole fact pattern was initially kind of talked over.
Right. Again, they're trying to, who can this stick to? So it's going to stick to Senator Feinstein.
Right.
Somehow she did something wrong.
Right.
By bringing this letter forward. So they're like looking for a target. And I think one of the other slipperier things they tried to do is so they don't look like they're completely discrediting the victim. Well, this may have happened to her, but it was somebody else.
Yes. I always call that the feel-good verdict or the feel-good discussion is, we think this happened to you, but. And if it was a criminal trial, it was always, but the state didn't prove it. And maybe sometimes we didn't, but sometimes it was we kind of like the defendant, but we think something happened. So we're going to say we believe you, but we're not going to go as far as, convicting this person or sentencing this person. So I call that the feel good.
So we believe you maybe 90%.
Yeah.
But that whole 10% of it was done by that
right. Which
defendant.
I mean, just to deviate from the book and the Kavanaugh thing, I mean, I think that situation was you either believed her or you didn't. And that fine tooth of we believe you, but it wasn't him. I mean, as well as I do, you talk to people who have gone through these traumatic experiences and it's it's in a vacuum, time stands still. They remember certain things. I have a hard time thinking the person says, it wasn't you. They may not have known the assailant, but I can't remember a case where they confused as to who, that I personally had.
Okay. Well, and I think Ford knew.
Well, that's what I mean, but I'm saying the public opinion saying, it happened to her, but it wasn't him.
Right.
Well, you either believe her or you don't.
Oh, and for them to even go so far as to bring in this third party, it could have been him. They go look in the yearbook. They find a guy who looked like Kavanaugh. Oh, my gosh.
Right.
I mean, just to throw the taint on this other guy.
Mm-hmm. I felt like if we were going to make someone be a witness and you're going to taint them, like the title of the book is, that they should have treated, if they were going to make it like a trial, they should have treated it like a trial. I mean, either you have a hearing or you have a trial. And you either call her into question, you either let her say what she wants to say and be done. But if you're going to go through a cross-examination, then and you're going to taint whatever she's saying or whoever, you know, even if it was a man who came forward, whoever, whatever they're saying, then give the time to determine whether or not they should be credible. Listen to other people. Look at other evidence.
And I think in the Anita Hill hearings, one of the senators said, what are the rules here?
Yes.
And so it was that. It was like, because what is this a hearing? Is this a trial? You know, what due process are we granting?
And I think we're muddier now. I think people are more divided now. And so anyone that comes forward now is jumping on a bandwagon and is immediately distrusted as opposed to the opposite.
It saddens me. We're going to, as we go through this conversation at the end, I told Rachel I want to end on an upbeat because we don't think the book necessarily did.
Right.
But I know it's like what woman, and again, Hill and Ford did not want to come forward.
Right.
So what woman would come forward even voluntarily?
Right.
They know they're going to get ensnared.
Right. And I think that in this instance, and even with Anita Hill, but even more so with Dr. Ford, which was you almost had an intellect, a very even, right? You had Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. Granted, he was going to be the Supreme Court, but she was a very educated, intelligent woman. Same situation here. You have obviously very intelligent man who's being put forward to the Supreme Court and a very intelligent woman. And those women were already immediately discredited.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes you think, if we're going to doubt people who you think are good, like you use the good versus bad, what happens to all those people that aren't educated, didn't come from a good background, maybe have a little bit of a checkered past with personal decisions? What is going to make them want to come forward?
Right. Ford was, criticized because of her anxiety.
Right.
Yeah. So, so even like what you would consider maybe the better victim.
Yes.
And I'm using that term because I think when you work in this field, whether it's, working with victims in the criminal court or in advocacy, we know victims that have, you said checkered past, but they have their own baggage.
Yes.
They have their own issues, and it's so easy to taint them with their own behaviors.
Which is sometimes the reason they have all that is because of what they have gone through.
Correct.
And so it's a cycle that's hard. So they come with taint.
Right. And I think when people learn about trauma, they start to, make those connections. But I think the general public, again, wants to separate themselves.
Right.
So we understand that piece of it, too. So what about in the court of public opinion? What do you think, with Hill and Ford, what do you think kind of came out of that?
Oh, well, again, I think with Hill, what initially came out was that stuff like this happens in the workplace. I mean, going back and reading the book and then remembering the time frame, it was, I had to remember, women didn't have protections in the workplace. So they didn't come forward and say things that they might nowadays because they'd lose their job. I mean, they still can. Obviously, we're a year or two out of the Me Too movement revival. And so I remembered, back then, when Anita Hill testified, it was, well, if it happened, you would have said something. And that was the public opinion. The commentary was, well, why? Mm-hmm. She'd lose her job. She couldn't. So then in that time, those decades, we've had more employee and her, protections and sexual harassment protections. But then we saw Me Too. And then we saw Dr. Ford. And so I think the public opinion swings. I think it's, yes, this is happening to women, so we need to do something about it. But yet when the women come out to talk about how it's happening, well, there must not be truth to that. So it's very hard sometimes for me to figure out, well, if we're swinging to give more protections, if we're swinging because we do agree that stuff is happening in the workplace and that women are discriminated against and sexually harassed or sexually assaulted, to whichever level it reaches, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a woman that says it's never happened, then why is it when they tell the full story, then the public doesn't want to believe? And that's the
Yeah, that's still
disconnect
the
puzzle. And I think maybe one thing that's the book is trying to say.
Yeah, we would hope. And so you kind of said it, and I think this is one of the arguments that we don't hear her making, but one is, why didn't you say it then?
Yes.
Is an argument. But the two that she uses are the he said, she said.
Yes.
And the nobody really knows what happened.
Yes.
And so we know the answer to why didn't you say it then?
Right.
It's the same reason why they don't want to say it now.
Right.
Because of just the reasons that we've seen.
Right.
They're not believed. They're attacked.
Right.
Their past is scrutinized. Things about them are pointed out to make them seem less credible. And they come away re-injured, re-victimized.
Yes, or they lose, if it's in the workplace. I mean, it's easy, someone who's like, I'm a professional. I mean, I'm an attorney. I can find another job. There are many women that cannot find another job. They're not in the economic situation. They have a job.
Right.
And that's the job they need.
And with laws about right-to-work states or at will, if a woman brought a complaint, and even though there's retaliation is not allowed, that's a whole nother fight you have then.
Right, yeah. Right.
So let's talk about the he said, she said. Nobody knows what happened.
Right.
And, the president, uses – it's so unfortunate that we have no leadership that comes out that takes a different point of view.
Yeah, the he said, she said, no one really knows what happens. Or kind of, I know Gilmore separates them, but to me, they're very connected. I mean, I think they're almost the same thing with a different phrase attached to it. But the he said, she said, and I'd like to point out, it could be she said, she said, he said, he said. We're talking about women, but it's pretty much people who come out and talk about sexual assault or sexual harassment. But obviously more, statistically, more women are victims and more men are perpetrators. But the he said, she said is just – it goes to that everything about these hearings that we've talked about and even the next few stories that Gilmore brings up, which is it's two people's word and it's we're just going to – and almost as if we're deciding who to believe based on your gender. That's why it's a he said, she said, or no one really knows.
Right.
You say A, he says B.
We're going to go with B.
We'll go with B.
Yeah.
and so that's – and I think – and the other examples that I know we're going to get to that she gets into the book, that's, outside of a courtroom setting, it's the same thing. You have different high-powered women or individual women who are coming forward to say things, and it's the, you say this and he says this, so we'll go with that.
And I guess I just want to add one other thing there, because I think the other part that's upsetting is, and the president said this for Kavanaugh, and, it was what Thomas said in his book, is that now they're the injured party.
Yes.
And now this fear that all young men should be afraid because women are just going to rampantly accuse them of things.
Yes. And, right. Well,
that's exhausting.
Right. What I thought you were also going to say is, but he's a good guy.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I was going to say that. You're a good mind reader.
Yeah. So, right. The first is that now you're injured. And I think about this and this story case came out. I don't know when Gilmore started working on this book, but the one that came out about a year ago with the swimmer from Stanford that had been caught in the act raping a drunken female or passed out female behind a dumpster, and that two good Samaritans came across on the bike and caught him. So it was really little question of what had happened. And then the judge was, your life is ruined now. And I think, and that's, again, like you said, with coming out about, Kavanaugh's life is ruined, and is that I don't know if the community wants to understand the effect that sexual assault has on people. I think it's a trauma that we can't see. You could see someone's injury from a car accident. You could see someone crutching around, but you don't see their internal trauma. And because they're often testifying about something years later, they are in a different healed spot. And so they're not the broken down, sobbing person. Well, even women initially after raped aren't necessarily sobbing.
Right.
People deal with trauma differently. But in our mind,
that's what
we expect. So when 5-10 years later, you're talking about it and you can have a conversation about it. So that means you must not be affected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the public, that's a education piece that I think we miss out on. And then the nice guy, that nice people can't do bad things. And that's just not true.
Right. Yes. I worked in corrections for 20 years. Yes. I certainly saw that too. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.7. I'm Judy Getty, and I have with me Rachel Granat, and we're talking about Tainted Witness, Why We Doubt What Women Say About Their Lives by Lee Gilmore. I'd like to switch the conversation now to her next example, which I also thought was a good example.
Yes, absolutely. Okay.
And this is, and I was not familiar with her story.
Neither was I.
Okay. So Rigoberto Menchu, and she writes a testimonial. She doesn't write it. She is interviewed, and it's her testimony is written. But it's a personal account of the crimes against humanity in Guatemala, which included the death of her father, and this took place in the 1980s. And through her dedication and her, you know, keeping this in the spotlight, she gets it into court in Guatemala, and there are actually convictions that result from this. But throughout these decades, while she's doing this, again, her testimony comes under scrutiny.
Yes, yes. And I was not familiar with her story either. And that was when we made the switch from court to this, public testimony more outside of a courtroom. Initially, like you said, she ends up in a courtroom. That's when I started thinking of, oh, this is another interesting way to look at how we judge what women say, because this is a woman who's not a politician, but obviously a well-known family in Guatemala for her, her father to be killed and for her to speak out. And obviously in a country also that probably, again, I haven't lived in Guatemala, but just from what I've heard, doesn't put women on the same even as men. And she's really putting herself out there. And the sense I got was also risking her own safety in doing so, because she knew what had happened to her father and she knew the atrocities that were happening, but she was willing to step down and everything she had to go through to keep this alive. In the criticisms that she received, which was ironic at the end when people are convicted. So you think, well, she was telling you the truth the whole time.
Right. Yeah, she's vindicated, I think. So, and I think she meets the standard of being a tainted witness. But I found it just interesting, again, contextually, how they tried to throw, who can we smear? And so there's the interesting thing is that the book, which is I, Rigoberto Menchu, it finds a forum on college campuses. And so different universities are using this for different courses. And one of the criticisms was that conservatives in the United States saw it as an attack on Western values and civilization, a perilous recasting of the evolution of such ideas as faith and justice as a legacy of sexism, racism, and the faults of its ruling classes.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I had made a note down here because just recently we had had a Difficult Dialogues event at the campus, and one of the things we had brought up was privilege with regards to, whether it's classes or ethnic groups or, social economic status or whatever, that there's this idea of privilege. And so one of the other professors who was conducting the event with me, she had a further discussion in her class the next day, and she was appalled because a student suggested that this was only a problem because we were talking about it.
Interesting.
And so, that put me in mind of, a lot of what she's saying, why are you bringing this up? It's sort of like, now we all have to think about this ugly thing or talk about this ugly thing, and it's detracting from this other, more lovely thing we want to be thinking about. Right. And it's only a problem because you brought it up.
Right. It's a lot of the, how it used to deal with family violence. Well, it's behind closed doors. We don't need to talk about it. Because if we don't talk about it, it's not happening.
And we don't have to do anything.
Right. And so, that's part of her bringing up stuff about Guatemala. We didn't know about it. Now that we know about it, we have to address it and we have to compare it. And it just seemed like an attack on her that was, that was unnecessary. I mean, she wasn't doing something to be for personal fame or fortune.
No.
She was speaking out to right the wrongs that nobody else, mind you, males included, were willing to do.
Right.
And then when you get to the end, because like I said, I didn't know the story. Mm-hmm. So when I got to the end and saw, oh, this didn't fizzle out, she used the word vindicated, which mm-hmm. I think is great. But no one wants to go back and say, oh, you were.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. 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 Oh, guess we were wrong.
Well, because I think, again, you know, contextually, she does a good job here. And so with her telling her story, she's also saying the United States is not nice all the time. You know, so yes. This image that we're this world savior, we're right. a world power, we only do good things, we're a country of humanitarian acts. And no.
Right.
No. In Guatemala and many other countries, United Fruit was really calling the shots
yes.
politically in that country.
Right.
And so the United States had the back of a government business.
Right. Well, right, because it benefited them.
Correct.
And they don't live there, so it's sort of like you said, if we don't know what's happening, it must not be happening. But now you've taken the blinders off of us. But instead of what I found interesting in Gilmore's discussion in picking this as an example was I think what it showed us is that it was instead of attacking her necessarily as directly as we had seen in Anita Hill, they were backing the other people. So it was almost like an indirect. I mean, they did attack her a bit too, but there was also an indirect way to taint her by backing the opposing side.
Right. And there was the one, I think he was a journalist, maybe a college professor, but who kind of picked apart again, looking
yes.
for, you know, and so this isn't necessarily true, and,
right.
and this isn't
right.
true. And again, I think Gilmore does a good job of saying, let's go back and look at those points.
Right.
And when we look at why did Rigoberto tell the story the way she did, and it was, like you said earlier, she was putting her life in jeopardy as well as some other people's.
Right.
And so she was trying to protect those other
yes,
people.
Yes, yes. And she knew, the other thing is a lot of the critics to her who were, you know, I do love the title, The Taint, were tainting her, weren't living her life. And so it's very easy from the outside of a situation to pick it apart, but you're not living in the everyday violence and stress of, and the political culture that was happening. So it was easier to attack her from the outside. Then understand, and I like when you brought up earlier that it all has to be looked in context. You can't just pull out her testimony or her testimonial and pick it apart without knowing where you pulled it from.
Right.
And I think that's what Gilmore is trying to point out. I had some this is the point in the book where I'm having a hard time following sometimes the avenue that she's trying to get there.
I'm so glad you said that because I think of myself as a smart person and I know you're a super smart person. So I think, oh my gosh, why am I not getting this?
Yes.
I'm sure she's making a logical or a rational argument and it's going to come around.
Right.
Right. But then it doesn't come around
right.
for me and I'm thinking, what am I missing?
Yes. I had the same thing. I thought, I mean, and then that's when I think I went back and I thought, oh yeah, she writes for a college because I thought, I feel like I'm reading a book assigned, you know, that I'm assigned in class and I'm supposed to be, and then I'm going to go to class, and my professor's going to connect all these dots that I'm missing. And maybe that's what I was missing.
We need to have a class.
Yes,
huh? We need to find a professor.
Was someone to say, yeah. Well, the reason this was the argument she was making, but they became too esoteric for me and almost lost the focus of what I thought was a really good example.
Right. And so this is where it goes downhill for us. So the,
yes.
after this, she brings up memoirs,
yes.
I guess. I would say. And I appreciated the perspective that, you know, women's memoirs have become prolific, I guess, and, you know, that women have this message. And the idea, again, is that, you know, I'm going to tell a story and other women are going to say, oh, I can relate to your
yes.
story. And so, I mean, you know, that's a good thing. But, okay, so both of us are saying, but where's the tainted witness part?
Yes.
Because I don't think she picked good examples then of women's stories who weren't believed that wrote in memoir.
I agree with you. Right. Because I think everything you just said about why memoirs are important, and then if we're speaking specifically about women, how it's empowering for other women, perhaps, to read them. And I thought that's not but people aren't tainting them. I mean, I think even men read those and find
them. Well, the example she gives that's a tainted memoirist is James Fry.
Right.
So she gives us a man who writes a story, sells it as a memoir. Oprah Winfrey comes to his, you know, like puts it on her book club.
Yeah.
And
then it turned out to be not, it's actually not believed to be false. He admits it's false.
Right. He says it's fictionalized.
Right.
And then this creates this whole fictionalized memoir genre.
Right. And that was the same with the Three Cups of Tea. Same type of, but again, two men that she used as examples as to how memoirs can be false, yet both of those men eventually admitted that they fictionalized portions of it, or it happened, but not in that, maybe that order.
Mm-hmm.
She actually doesn't discredit any of the female memoirs that she points out. Well, she has a different attack on them.
The one thing I thought, here we come back around with James Frey's book,
okay.
Because when Oprah Winfrey gets him back on the show to confront him.
Right.
And then it seemed that the court of public opinion, you know, he got the sympathy and it was like the taint stuck to her.
Yes.
So I thought, okay, that's what Gilmore was getting at. That, you know, that, you know, some woman still has to suffer for this.
Right. And I made a note of that in my book as well, that he doesn't get any of the criticism that she does.
Right. Sounds like she should have known better. She picks these books. We were all supposed to buy these books.
Right.
And she picked this book that was, you know, not what it was sold to be.
Right.
And it's her fault.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then she's just kind of covering herself by bringing him back on, which maybe for her, but it was a legitimate reason.
Right.
She wasn't making up that he made it up. I mean, it came out in the public that this was not true.
And he should have owned that and vindicated her. You know, I'm sorry that you were misled.
Yes. But again, my note, that's the point you brought up. My note before we even talked about what we were going to talk about was that he didn't have any of the suffering from his lie.
No, he didn't. So now let's talk about the memoir she does bring up. She brings up Elizabeth Gilbert, Eat, Pray, Love. She brings up Cheryl Strayed, Wild, The Kiss by Katherine Harrison. I saw the movie. I did not read the book.
Wow. Okay, yeah. I did not read The Kiss, but I've read Wild and Eat, Pray, Love. I read Wild, actually, with a book club, so I've discussed that book with other people, and when she started using those memoirs as tainted witnesses, I initially thought it was going to be a different how other people question them. You know, they've put themselves and they put their stories out here, and now their public opinion is tainting them or telling them they're not true. But that wasn't it. She was picking apart their memoirs. So I felt like there was this big shift, right? The first two stories she's bringing up, or the first two examples, how the public or communities or people, you know, society views these women who have come forward and how they are made to be, you know, lying or less credible. But now suddenly we moved into the memoirs and she's turned into picking apart them and how they don't really stand for almost like they're because they're telling their stories, they want and they're using the word I. She was really bothered by the fact that
because we're not, our background is not English or literature criticism. I think this is where we probably are hung up, and I should have maybe had a, you know, somebody who's an English professor.
Maybe, right. That's right.
But yeah, you're right, and that's where she lost me too. But I think neither one of us read the book, The Kiss, but I think her argument with that one was that because that story by Katherine Harrison is that she forms an incestuous relationship. I shouldn't say she forms. Her father forms the relationship.
Right.
She's really victimized with her. But she's 20.
Yes.
And she's attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this sort of idea that because she was 20 and because she was an attractive woman, she must have had more agency in that relationship. And so it didn't seem to be any sympathy for her.
Right. This is really where the author lost me because, again, it seems like she's saying that, not so much that's what others are saying. Or maybe she's just not relaying that through her writing as well to me.
Okay.
But you have to so understand the dynamics of sexual abuse and to understand why she would be victimized. And I feel like by pointing that part out. Well, she was 20 and she was attractive. but it was her father. I mean, you have to go back and think about, and who knows, I mean,
she doesn't contextualize that one for
us. And what about, was, you know, I, we know there are offenders that groom till age of legality. So, you don't just one day wake up and start sexually abusing your child. It might seem that way, but there's a process to get there. And so I feel like pulling that example out without the contextual background of how that could happen and why she can still be a victim, it was lost.
And I think that could have been a really good example of a tainted witness because... But, you know, and I'm just hypothesizing here or supposing, because if Harrison is telling that story, it would be very easy for her, the public, to turn on her.
Absolutely.
And say, oh, come on.
Right.
You want us to feel sorry for you?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so I thought... I just thought that that was the wrong book to bring up because it's so laden with other issues, and you're not really defending her. Like the whole point of this book is why we don't believe women.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got to the kiss, she's on the bandwagon of not how I felt, not believing her. Instead of pointing out what you said, here's all these. Look, people didn't like her. This is, she got immediately attacked. But let's break this down.
Yeah, let's look at
and
why.
I didn't get that. It just and she kept coming back to the kiss over and over and over again. But then also putting in the same category as Wild and Eat, Pray, Love, which to me are three totally distinct memoirs.
Yes,
with women that went through total. I mean, Eat, Pray, Love isn't even necessarily someone coming from. You know, self-destruction, doubt, right, and jumping forward. It's a different quest.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't connect.
Why she chose those.
Why she chose those, why she put them together, and how they even fit.
The argument she's trying to make.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. So, okay, we're going to head into our last few minutes here. So I just want to let our listeners know that you are hearing us talk about Tainted Witness, Why We Doubt What Women Say About Their Lives by Lee Gilmore. And Rachel and I loved the first part of the book, and now we're talking about how the author has just lost us. So the chapter on, and you kind of gave a little hint of this one, like three cups of tea and then half the sky. I've read both of those.
Okay, but I only read three cups of tea.
So her criticism here is that these are girls who have international, the stories of international girls who need help.
Yes.
And so now I'm wondering what, and again, I'm trying to formulate the words because I'm thinking, why would she include that?
Yes, I could not. I had to go back and reread a couple of the introductory paragraphs to see what I was missing.
And okay, you said it. I mean, three cups of tea, it turns out that Mortensen fabricated some of how that came about, and then turns out he was taking money from the foundation and not using it properly. So that was all bad. But the other book is very moving, and I think the authors do a good job of presenting the stories of these women. I think the criticism Gilmore had was that here we have these white men telling these stories about women, telling their stories, you know, doing testimony for them.
Right. But, and I get that as an argument, kind of. But we'll go with it right now. But when I look back to, I always go back to your introduction and to the title. What was it that you were trying to get across to us? Why did I buy this
book? Why is this
book?
An example?
Right. I bought this book to read about why we're not, why as a society, or you said, as do we not believe women who come forward with whatever issue it is, be it rape or poverty or murder or, you know, political agendas, whatever it is. But what now we've moved to, why do we need white men to tell young girls' stories? And I thought, but that's a different issue, first of all. And second of all, you're talking about young girls in countries where they have no voice. So someone has to give them a voice.
Right.
And shouldn't we just be happy that someone is giving them a voice?
So is it that we wouldn't believe them if they told us directly? So this is part of the example. In one of my classes, I use a TED Talk by Jackson Katz. You're probably familiar with him. He's an anti-violence educator. And he talks about why violence against women is a men's issue.
Yes, I think I may have seen that.
Okay. And so, you know, part of me says, you know, we don't need anybody coming in on a white horse to save us. Right. So there's that line of thinking.
Yes.
But the other part is, in Jackson Katz talks about this, men need to stand up because they will be hurt.
Yes.
He goes, and that's not fair and it's sexist, but that is the reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so men have to stand up and tell those stories.
It can't be a women's issue.
Right. Because then it's more...
Right.
Believable.
Yes.
And so, but do we just reinforce that then by allowing that, by saying, please tell my story because they'll believe you?
Yeah. You know, to me, when I read, like I said, I'd read Three Cups of Tea and I hadn't read the other book, but just in other memoirs that I've read, you know, talking about women is, I've never thought that. And maybe that's just me. I'm more interested in the story that's being told,
mm-hmm.
not the who's the telling of the story. So, but maybe for somebody involved in women's studies, that intricacy is important, but it wasn't important in what I thought we were talking about in the book, because I'm looking at it as to, well, why are we not believing these girls? If we're talking about tainted witness, why don't we believe what women say?
Yeah.
It should have been, why are we not believing these girls talking about their life? But everyone gets behind that these are exactly what's happening to their lives.
Yes.
So I just...
It was a poor example.
It was a very poor example.
It's a whole other conversation.
And the whole chapters were going after how this white male was discredited, which takes the focus away from talking about the girls or females or mm-hmm. the other issues at hand.
Let's talk about one other, because it starts out as a criminal case, and we have a few minutes left. And I really don't know how to pronounce the name, but Nafissatou Diallo. And I remember this case.
Me too.
She's a hotel maid.
Yep.
And she goes into a room. She thinks it's empty, and she is raped by Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who is a diplomat from France. And in the... I thought, again, kind of interesting. I mean, initially they believe her.
Yes.
And it could be a he said, she said, but there's a lot of other evidence.
Right, right.
And, well, why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because as a former prosecutor, what did you
Oh,
think?
Gosh. Well, I think the fact that they initially believed her was interesting, because just on the socioeconomic dynamic that you even brought up and who he was and who she was, normally she would have been discredited.
Yeah.
Like, well, you're just trying to get fame and fortune. You know, you've found someone that you can go after, et cetera. So I found that the fact that people initially believed her was sort of an odd situation. But I also do remember this case as well. I mean, I think a lot of what comes out is I think it was her, maybe. I was trying to put my finger on why she's credible. And I think it's because she acts how people think you're supposed to act. I mean, she comes forward. She tells people what happened. She doesn't, you know, wait a long period of time before disclosing. She's kind of in the raw.
She has injuries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
that's,
there's physical
right,
evidence.
And that's the whole thing with why do we doubt what women say? Because once there's something other than what they say, there's credibility. So an injury,
mm-hmm.
A video. A phone call where the person's recorded making some admissions. Another victim with the exact same information that comes forward and says, here's what happened to me, and it matches. Anything that's other than what they say, people can jump on that behind it, because they're not getting behind necessarily what she's saying. They're getting behind the proof that supported it.
Interesting.
So that's,
okay. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
how I saw her.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also isn't quite as innocent as the other example she gives, initially.
Well, and then she takes us down, you know, and I think, okay, she's going to give us these other pieces now and she'll explain them. But the piece she doesn't explain is that when she is interviewed by the detectives and she tells the story about what happened to her in, now I'm sorry, I'm forgetting where she's from.
Another country. Was it an African country?
I think it was African.
Yes.
But she tells a story about being raped that was not true.
Yes.
Now, she was an asylum seeker, and she came into this country because she had been on safe in her own country.
Right.
But that wasn't the story she told. Yes. That was not on her application. What was on her application
was something different than what she tells the police officer.
And so there's no explanation of why did she tell that story.
I felt like there was a hole there. And it actually made me make a note and think, well, I might not look, I just for my own edification look into that, because it's too much of a gap for me to think there was a reason why. I feel like we jumped. We jumped over a big – there's something else happened in there, I feel like it's too diverse to have been one to the other. Mm-hmm. There was some justification, and either we weren't getting it or it wasn't relevant to what Gilmore was trying to say. But it almost – it was a very disjointed –
it was almost like she said, I'm losing my focus in this book. I'm just going to ramble for a few more pages.
Yeah,
it was, and then, you know,
and it actually
160 call it
and
good.
It actually does nothing to help explain why people didn't believe Diallo. It just says, well, she ended up lying, so therefore we can't believe her. And that's it. When I feel like Anita Hill, we spent all this time explaining why we should believe her. We got to Diallo's. We're like, well, she made a lie, so we don't believe her. And I'm like, well, now you're kind of playing into what your title's trying
but it
to
does,
talk
they,
against.
Do they, remind me, do they not hear the case?
And I think it gets dismissed.
It's dismissed.
Yeah,
okay.
If I remember correctly.
But again, let's give Diallo credit. She takes it to civil court, and she wins.
And she wins.
Yeah.
Yes, which is showing that she was believed.
At least to, with the preponderance of the evidence.
Right, enough that she was wronged by him.
Right.
Which to me means it happened, because the wrong was him raping her.
Correct.
So, I feel as you would like, we're getting done with the book, you know, we got to get done with the show. Let's just, like, put a bow on it, and I need to get it to publication.
Yeah, which was so disappointing, because I think, you know, all of the conversation we had, which I think was a really good conversation about how we could have helped her at that point.
I know, right.
So anything that you think we've missed? I know you've talked to a lot of women, and women probably come in with the belief they're not going to be believed.
Oh, they do. You know that. You know, especially, I mean, yes and no. Some are very empowered by what they hear in the community of people coming out more with their stories that I can be believed. And so in some ways, it's empowering to people to come forward. But once they get involved, they realize it's going to be a long road. And what I've noticed is you never know which ones are going to be the ones that are strong enough to keep going. But I consider, I mean, my thing is, I know you want to end happy. So what I will say is that I feel like anyone that comes forward, you know, they're the true heroes. They're bringing, you know, either justice to the person that did this to them. They're, you know, least exposing it, so maybe it won't happen to anybody else. And if you can just convince one person out in society that they should take a different look at things and believe what's being said, then, you know, they've done
and
something
I'll just say,
good.
And that's what I was hoping the Me Too movement was, you know, starting to push forward, that if all of us, you know, can say Me Too, Me Too, Me Too, and there's that chorus, that whoever has to now come forward, the chorus is there for them.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, well, I feel like I ran a marathon.
I know.
And you run marathons, I don't even know what I'm talking about. But I want to thank Rachel for joining me to discuss Tainted Witness, Why We Doubt What Women Say About Their Lives by Leigh Gilmore. Thank you.
And thank you, Jude.
Please join me next month when I have my annual December book talk with my daughters. We will be reading Lucky Boy by Shanti Sakaran. And this is a story about illegal immigration and adoption, so another very topical kind of issue. I also want to remind listeners that Big Cabbage Radio is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you, so please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading.